I'd often appreciated the idea of getting a chair, perhaps at Oxford or Cambridge or somewhere in America, a distinguished chair. I realized that there are more material and practical chairs that we need, so I'm glad to see people bringing their own chairs in as they come. This is a series of lectures we have. Due to the generosity of Alexander Majewski, we have a lecture each term. Last year we had Friedhelm Hardy and Gavin Flood, and David Smith was here in Michaelmas term. And next term, Sanjukta Gupta of the Oriental Faculty will be speaking on May 19th on the iconography of the goddess. But we are very happy tonight to have a very distinguished speaker in our presence, Professor Julius Lipner from Cambridge University. He is known to many of you. And come in, please. Julius was born in India, brought up in India, educated King's College London for his PhD, and has ever since been on the Divinity Faculty at the University of Cambridge, where he is a professor and currently, I believe, the chair of the Faculty of Divinity. He was also the first director of the Dharam Hinduja Institute of Indic Culture, a very prestigious position, also one that I believe required great political skills and the savvy of combining and pleasing many different groups, and Julius did it extremely well. His range of interests are in traditional Hinduism, such as Ramanuja in the south of India, also the history of the Christian-Hindu interaction in the Indian context, also very comparative themes, like themes in Christian theological reflection, and how these themes have worked out in the Hindu context as well. He is a very well-published author, many, many articles, reviews, in-depth articles, the kind of articles you like to keep and use for reference in your teaching. And a number of books, I'll just mention a few of them. 1986, The Face of Truth, A Study of Meaning and Metaphysics in the Vedantic Theology of Ramanuja, co-edited with Harold Coward in 1989, Hindu Ethics, Purity, Abortion, and Euthanasia. 1994, a very popular and well-used introductory book on Hinduism, Hindus, Their Religious Beliefs and Practices. A lovely title for the next book from 1997, essays actually from a conference, the Dharam Hinduja conference in Cambridge, The Fruits of Our Desiring, An Inquiry into the Ethics of the Bhagavad Gita for Our Times. And then in 1999, a book on the very famous figure at the end of the 19th century who crossed the boundaries between the Hindu and Christian contexts, Brahmabandhav Upadhyay, The Life and Thought of a Revolutionary. Along with that, Julius was also working with Father Gisbert Souch in New Delhi on bringing out two volumes of the writings of Brahmabandhav Upadhyay from the Bengali and English, and I think Julius spent a lot of time in dusty archives in Calcutta finding old magazines and old journals and making translations of things from the Bengali. My own experience over the years has been that Professor Lipner is a wonderful combination of the learned scholar and the wonderful teacher, and as I said, the person who seems to have sensitivities that cross the boundaries between East and West. So I can hardly think of a better speaker who can explain to us tonight what exactly Hinduism is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Professor Clooney, for that very generous introduction. And it's a great honor to be here to give the Majewski lecture, and especially sponsored by the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. It's doing wonderful work here. I've followed its progress, and I'm very honored to be associated with the Institute, with the Center. It's building important bridges of understanding between different cultures and different religious traditions, and as you all are aware, we need that increasingly in our time. So I'm particularly happy to be here for that reason. Now, I'm not sure what I'm billed to speak on, but I've called it on defining Hinduism. Are we all in the right place at the right time? Well, it's a very fat lecture, and I don't want to keep you here till 8 o'clock tonight, especially since I'm invited for dinner after this occasion. So what I'll do is I'll read some and I'll speak some, but be aware that there are many points that I won't be able to cover, but perhaps we can raise them in the discussion, which I hope to leave time for at the end. The session must finish by 6:30. Is that right? Okay.
I think that would be
fine. Because please note, I started 10 past five. Yes.
Don't worry about that.
Okay. Well, the purpose of this lecture is not to attempt some comprehensive account of what Hinduism is. My task is one of orientation, to attempt a constructive critique of what various commentators have considered Hinduism to be, and to suggest what I believe to be a fruitful approach to the totality we call Hinduism. Now, I cannot claim that the approach outlined in this lecture is the only fruitful way of understanding Hinduism, of course, but it occurs to me that there are many different ways of being human. There are many different ways of culturally, religiously, and otherwise expressing what it is to be human, not just one way. And similarly, there are a number of different ways of being Hindu. And it's important to keep in mind, especially today when people in the subcontinent and perhaps elsewhere are talking about normative ways of being Hindu, that this is the case, so that my approach is such as to leave space for different modes, different ways of being Hindu, and not to speak in an essentialist manner, as if there were only one way. If ever I were to write again on what Hinduism is, I wouldn't speak of the Hindu view of life, as Radhakrishnan did, but a Hindu view of life. So there are some approaches, nevertheless, to our subject that are more fruitful than others. And I shall argue that the one outlined here in the second half of the lecture has particular advantages, and that there are other approaches which are unhelpful. They do not seem to square with how the majority of people we have called Hindus over the ages have behaved, or with what they claim their basic values and purposes in life to be. So first of all, let us ask, is there such a thing as Hinduism at all? And if so, what kind of thing is it? What are the pitfalls of using the term Hinduism unwarily? And I'll start, therefore, with a historical perspective of the task at hand to show you how complex and political the situation might be. The English word Hinduism is of fairly recent coinage, not much more than a couple of centuries old. Will Sweetman, in his recent book just published, Mapping Hinduism, has gone into this question at some length and has pushed back the boundaries of when the term Hinduism was used to the late 18th century. But that's neither here nor there. It's not a translation, this term, of some early Indian term purporting to give a self-description of Indian religion or culture. It is a Western invention created for a specific purpose. But it was not entirely plucked out of thin air. Part of this name, the Hindu element in Hinduism, is derived from the name of the great river, the Indus, which runs along the northwest of the subcontinent with its tributaries. The word Indus itself seems to have been derived from the description which ancient inhabitants of this region gave to this riverine system, recorded at least as long ago as the second millennium BCE. This area is historically important for our purposes because along its banks, or former banks, because the river has moved over time, there are sites where civilization in the Indian subcontinent had an early flowering, in the technical sense of civilization, with urban centers and their civic, socio-political, and communicational infrastructure, together with various forms of architectural, commercial, artistic, and ritual expression. We have archaeological records of this civilization from about 3000 BCE. Now, the precise ethnic and cultural relationship between the ancient inhabitants from whose description of the river we have derived the present name on the one hand, let's call them the Aryans, a contentious name, And the great civilization mentioned above on the other, the Indus civilization, is part of the issue we are considering. In their multi-dialect language, which they described as Samskrita, meaning refined or polished, from which we get the English word Sanskrit, the Aryans called the rivers of the northwest, especially its main artery, Sindhu. Subsequent invaders or immigrants from beyond the northwest, the Persians, circa 550 BCE, the Greeks from the early 4th century BCE, and the Muslims, 8th, 9th century CE onwards, used the element Ind from Sindhu in their names for the land and all the peoples to the east of this river. Thus the Greeks spoke of Indikoi, Indians, while Arabic-speaking Muslims referred to the land as Al-Hind. And gradually after the arrival of the British, the terms India and Hindu and Hinduism, IND, became current. Now there's a vigorous ideological debate current as to who the Aryans originally were and where their homeland was. Arya means noble in Sanskrit. So by way of self-description, it's interesting how people describe themselves in such glowing terms. The Aryans were the noble ones, those whose language and lifestyle were superior to the culture of non-Aryans. It is not difficult to see then that any debate about the Aryans' ethnicity can have strong political overtones. Were these noble peoples, whose developing language and culture gradually dominated civilized India, indigenous inhabitants historically, that is in some sense locals or native, or did they come from elsewhere? In other words, is traditional Indian civilization, with its reputation today of being artistically highly developed, linguistically sophisticated, mythologically rich, and philosophically and theologically profound, rooted originally in the soil or not? The political implications are not hard to see. Now, there are three groups of views, or rather there are three groups of people having respective views about this question of the indigeneity or not of the Aryans. Members of one group argue that the Aryans were indigenous, that they constituted or were part of the first older Indus civilization, rather than supplanting it by some form of intrusion. They're not happy with the view that the Aryans came from outside, whose culture took over from the Indus culture and created a substantial part of the infrastructure we call Hinduism today. They're not hospitable to outside influences affecting in any significant way what they regard as the core or essentials of the Hindu view of life. And the main reason seems to be that they wish to draw lines of exclusion between what they regard as their own cultural domain and that of others, especially Muslims and Westerners, mediated by British colonial rule, who entered India in significant numbers for long periods of hegemonic rule, certain parts of the country. So a particular view of Hinduism prevails here, that it is a block reality, monolithic, with discernible essentials or an identifiable core. This perception can then be manipulated for certain ends, for determining who a true daughter or son of the soil is, and for prescribing, it's a prescriptive view, what the outsider must do to be accepted. And some of these ideologues even go so far as to say that the heartland of the Indus civilization was the original home of the Aryans, who then spread to other parts of the world. So that is one view. Members of another party also favor the conclusion that the Aryans were indigenous, but interestingly for other reasons. If it can be agreed that so-called Aryan culture originated in the subcontinent, then subsequent distinctive socio-economic discriminations, which have been embedded within the system for nearly three millennia, and which were from early times reckoned to be congenital, they really are referring to the phenomenon of caste, have in fact no real historical ethnic basis. If the Hindu caste structure was originally superimposed from within the system, then it can be removed from within the system in favor of modern perceptions of a more egalitarian way of life. In short, Hindus can clean up their own act without violating the essential integrity of their cultural roots. And I've often heard Marxists tend to espouse this kind of view. But there's a third position, which is argued almost exclusively on archaeological grounds. Let us call it the archaeological stance. This position is dismissive of the arguments of the so-called historical linguists, whose case rests mainly on the way they perceive speech patterns to migrate, based on comparative philological analysis. According to these language experts or comparative philologists, there is strong evidence for an Aryan incursion. And here Aryan refers primarily to modes of speech and culture, from beyond the northwest into the Indus Valley during the later phases of the Indus civilization, about 1500 to 1200 BCE. It is these language specialists who have had the main influence hitherto in shaping the received scenario of Aryan presence in India. But this archaeological stance disregards the claims of these comparative philologists based on archaeological evidence. And it disregards these claims as unsubstantiated and misguided. According to the archaeological stance, the Indus civilization, whose early phases began in about 4000 BCE, was a development of the wheat and barley-based agriculture that was part of a broad interaction zone from the Oxus Valley in North Afghanistan to the Indus Valley. This kind of agriculture was itself linked to the general agricultural growth between the Balkans and Balochistan, traceable to about 7000 BCE. And as it matured, the so-called Indus civilization developed more or less independently. Its core area was not sites along the Indus River system, as maintained in the inherited philological scenario, but the now dried-up river valley in the Bahawalpur region of present-day Pakistan. This region was originally watered by the Saraswati River, which is mentioned often in the Rig Veda, the early stratum of the canonical scriptures, the Vedas. But as the Saraswati River began to dry up, there was a steady shifting of sites eastwards into inner India. Thus, the Aryans who composed the Vedas were in fact Indus Valley peoples, users of the Indo-Aryan language family, and with a long history of 3,000 years already behind them. The Vedas could have developed autonomously in the fold of the various phases of the Indus civilization, whose longevity eventually allowed it to spread massively towards the south and east, and may well have formed the core of the civilization's religio-cultural beliefs and thence of Hinduism as we know it subsequently. So this archaeological stance seeks seriously to challenge the very basis of the received scenario. Now, there is a fourth view which I wish to record here, and that is a kind of merging of the philological received scenario with the archaeological stance. And that is that probably by a trickle or knock-on effect over many previous generations, peoples whose culture may be described as Aryan had penetrated the Indus region from places more or less distant east of the Great River, the Indus. These peoples seem to have incorporated aspects of early European ancestry and ways of life, and in the course of time mingled to greater or lesser degree through intermarriage and otherwise with the inhabitants of the Indus civilization. In time, over centuries, the developing language and culture spread hegemonically, though unevenly, over the entire subcontinent. The gradual penetration and dispersion of the so-called Aryans on this scenario may well make it possible to accommodate the apparently unbroken archaeological sequence, as emphasized by the archaeological stance, of the rise, decline, and aftermath of the Indus civilization. And all these four views are heavily charged politically, especially in modern India. We'll come back to this later. But this view is ideologically attractive to another group of people who wish to depict the cultural tradition called Hinduism as a culture of synthesis, and by implication of basic patterns of tolerance. Hinduism for them has derived from a converging of ideas and practices and from a mingling of peoples. The culture that subsequently held sway, however objectionably it may have done so in certain circumstances, for example by discriminations of caste and androcentrism, was nevertheless the result of syntheses of various kinds. Hinduism, therefore, was not built on purist foundations, but on compromise. And notwithstanding the frailties of history, the tradition today, too, must be able to act hospitably towards immigrants and their ideas. The real nobility of Hinduism, its Aryanness for this fourth group, is its essentially tolerant nature. This is the position of cultural inclusivists or pluralists. So there's nothing like a neutral, politically neutral stance as to what Hinduism is or how it developed, especially in the charged debate of modern times. And all four of these stances have strong internal and external political overtones. Okay, so is there no evidence to decide the matter? Ah, that wonderful word, evidence. But we know evidence that is supposed to decide racial and cultural roots and the origins of ideas and practices is usually loaded with interpretation. And the evidence in this case, which is mainly linguistic, anthropological, and archaeological, is still fragmentary. It is constantly being added to, revisited, reinterpreted. It is not to my purpose to review the evidence here, and it is certainly not the case that all those concerned with this question are ideologically enslaved. I don't want to give that impression. Nevertheless, it is my view that a dispassionate inquiry into the data available supports some version of the received scenario, though important adjustments in our understanding of the mingling of the old and new inhabitants of northwestern India during the first few millennia BCE and perhaps earlier with regard to the diffusion of speech patterns and other cultural traits will have to be made to incorporate the archaeological stance. But that's not quite the point of our discussion. The point is that Hinduism is a construct, the result of interpreting the evidence and being continually open to fresh interpretations and evidence. Indeed, this is why there can be a number of fruitful approaches to Hinduism. But this does not mean that the evidence we have is by nature so pliable that any interpretation goes, so long as it makes sense. In fact, there are plenty of hard features to Hinduism, particular beliefs, practices, myths, symbols, artifacts, and so on, which are generally agreed to be incontestably Hindu. And it is important to enter into a dialectical relationship with the evidence, to interrogate it and to allow it to interrogate us, in order to arrive at some kind of objective, in inverted commas, conclusion on the matter. The nature of the questions we ask will be regulated by the epistemological principles and code of conduct generally agreed by those with professional expertise in the relevant disciplines. In other words, the code of conduct of those recognized as scholars in the subject. So let us return to the idea that the word Hinduism refers to a construct, to a certain configuration of data. It is an abstract term, Hinduism, implying a tendency to generalization, obliquely derived from the Sanskrit term Sindhu. It is about 200 years old, though the English word Hindu seems to have been in use well over a century earlier. But this does not mean that these words and their Western equivalents were invariably employed in the course of their history with the same set of preconceptions by Western writers. And let me inquire into this briefly. Let us look at the so-called Orientalist view, where Orientalist refers to Western ways, quote, of dominating, restructuring, and having authority over the Orient. And this is to quote from Said's famous work. That is, of institutionalizing psychological, political, social, religious, and other structures for expressing superiority over the East, whatever that might mean. Because of colonialism and its vested interests, Orientalism has had a long and vigorous history with regard to India and the term Hinduism. And the term Hinduism has been a major carrier of this project. Even today, though we are being increasingly alerted methodologically to Orientalist strategies, words such as Hinduism continue to be invested with Orientalist connotations, not only in the media, but also in scholarly works, but not least in the media and its ramifications. How many of you have been on the Indiana Jones ride in Disneyland? I must confess that I have done this too. And there you see several times. There you see this large, horrific image of Kali, who dominates the ride, the Indiana Jones film and so on, where Kali has been used as a destructive ogress. Hinduism in this respect is up for grabs. I don't think you would see this similarly in any Muslim context. And as you know, this has been a problem with regard to the presentation, the image, to some extent, of what passes for Hinduism or Hindu ideas and aspects in the West. But early Western studies of religious practices and beliefs of India, we would now describe as Hindu, were generally aware that such behavior did not constitute a single monolithic faith. And now I want to say a few words to rehabilitate early Western scholarship away from the Orientalist image. On the contrary, these studies were keen to point to significant doctrinal and other variations, even to the extent of declaring that these variations amounted to the existence of different but related religions. Thus, as early as the 17th century, Roberto de Nobili, a Jesuit missionary in South India, could write that the people he studied, quote, have one public way of life, but many religions, unquote. And already in 1846, the noted British Indologist H.H. Wilson declared in the opening sentence of his sketch of the religious sects of the Hindus that, I quote, the Hindu religion is a term that has been hitherto employed in a collective sense to designate a faith and worship of an almost endlessly diversified description, unquote. Now, these are not blunt references to the nature of Hindu religion, and they indicate that in the past, Western understandings of religious Hinduism were not always unnuanced. This goes against the view generally held today that a methodologically sensitive approach to the study of Hindu religion has been only a recent development. In fact, as we have seen, Western observers of the past were aware that religious Hinduism was a diversified phenomenon, and this has provided some precedent for the views of those contemporary scholars such as von Stetenkron and myself, who maintain that traditional Hinduism in its religious aspects is appropriately conceptualized as a group of related religions rather than as one homogenized faith. Thus, we see that from both past and current Western usage, the terms Hinduism and Hindu are susceptible of methodological sensitivity and pliable application. As such, they can be both linguistically and cognitively useful. It need not be the case, then, as W.C. Smith and R.E. Frickenberg, for example, believe that the term Hinduism is hopelessly vitiated as a semantic tool. Now I want to consider briefly what traditional senses of identity people we call Hindu had about themselves and how they used the terms Hindu and Hinduism as a self-ascriptive marker, self-ascriptive term. How have Hindus sought to identify or describe themselves and their own traditions? Now, I've pointed out that already that the term Hindu, not to mention Hinduism, is not very old, and that it seems to acquire some currency in Western circles from about the early 17th century, at least Hindu. In Indian usage, it has an even more murky past, in that its history is still obscure. It has been pointed out that the term was used in Indian texts in medieval and late medieval times, often in a context demarcating Hindus from Muslims. I've got all the footnotes here in case you want references later. An earlier reference, but not much earlier, occurs in the medieval Hindi poems of the North Indian saint Kabir, 15th century, who himself eludes neat classification in terms of the modern category Hindu. Thus, there is a tradition that when he died, both Muslims and the other side, Hindus, wished to claim his body for disposal according to the rites of their own faiths. And I go into a few quotations from Kabir where he speaks of the Gorakhnaths, of Ram Ram, says the Hindu, Gorakh Gorakh cries the Jogi, Allah is one, proclaims the Muslim, but my Lord pervades all. And again he says, the God of the Hindus resides in a temple, the God of Muslims resides in a mosque. Who resides there where there are no temples or mosques? And even here, Hindu is not a straightforward category, because he distinguishes in these words the Jogi from the Hindu and the Muslim. And today, a Yogi would fall probably under the category of Hindu. So this indicates not only how malleable the term Hindu has been even among Indians themselves, but also that it was used as a self-ascriptive marker by Hindus to separate themselves from others who did not share their way of life. Here the term tended to be appropriated with an exclusivistic function. But more traditionally, however, Hindus affirmed identity and marked exclusion in other ways. For example, by referring to differences of doctrinal belief by such designations as Sri Vaishnava, Prabhakara, Pashupata, Baudha, that's an exclusive term, or to specific practices on Sinya, Kanpata, Splitia, Kapalika, skull bearer, or to occupation, Sairandri, that is a maidservant, or personal names, Radha, Rama, Madhva, or family descent, Yadava, Kaunteya, Janaki, or particular achievements or qualities, Savyasachi, ambidextrous, Vrikodara, wolf belly, Nilakanta, dark throat, or birth group, Brahmin, Khatri, Baniya, or ancestral village or race, Yavana, Mlecha, and so on. It is important to note that individuals or groups were accustomed to being referred to by more than one designation concurrently, as context demanded. Thus, within the space of a day or a single episode, an individual could be referred to by different designations: scorcher of the foe in battle, ruler of my heart in the home, Bigfoot by way of jest or insult, and Mura more matter-of-factly, depending on the intention of the speaker. In other words, Hindus traditionally functioned in terms of multiple identity appellations, and this reflected the complex and multi-layered social world in which they lived and continue to live. Even today, this is a feature of Hindu social relations, though with a somewhat reduced scope. Thus, this polycentric dynamic, that is, having multi-centered identities, generated and still generates a fluid sense of identity and encourages continuous oscillation from one identity context to another as and when need arises. We shall return to this distinctive general trait of polycentrism in Hinduism later. Now I want to say a few words about modern tendencies. So what I've tried to describe so far is how traditionally the term Hindu has been used by people we are pleased to call Hindus today, how it is based in a polycentric world of multiple identity appellations, the history of the term Hinduism, the various political factions involved, and the various political kinds of agenda that are involved even today in this one apparently neutral term, Hinduism. And this takes us to now modern tendencies. But there's no doubt that in some respects, in some political and religious contexts, the term Hindu has become a catch-all category, used to homogenize identity with a view to making broad, often tendentious distinctions. This goes against the sense of process mentioned above. In other words, the terms Hindu and Hinduism are being used increasingly to forge ways of speaking and thinking that go against traditional practices, both personally and collectively. And this has been an important modern development in the history of these terms and needs further elucidation. At this point, I want to bring into the discussion a term that functions as a contemporary slogan about Hindu identity, in debates about Hindu identity, with repercussions for a particular approach to Hinduism which I do not favor. And this term is Hindutva, which is best translated by Hinduness to mean the defining characteristic or characteristics of what is Hindu. Now, I've done a little research on the history of the term Hindutva, which, as some of you know, is so important ideologically in right-wing and fundamentalist circles today under BJP rule. And to understand the history of Hindutva, we must go back to a famous Bengali novel of the late 19th century. This novel, called Anandamat by Bankimchandra Chatterjee, his dates are 1838 to 1894, was first published in book form in 1882 and soon became one of the sources for the development of Hindu nationalist consciousness, especially in Bengal, which pioneered the movement to free India from colonial rule. Though the novel was published in book form in 1882, it is set in the Great Bengal Famine of 1770, a century earlier, in space that was being contested by the British, the Mughal rulers and Muslim rulers of that part of India, and the local Jomidars, the great landholders of eastern Bengal. So it is set in a context where the land itself and its identity is up for grabs. And it depicts the story of, you can call them, an order of Bengali freedom fighters called Shontans. And Shontan means child in Bengali. The Shontans are children of their motherland, which is identified with the nurturing yet avenging mother goddess. Thus, the dominant symbolism of this book is uncompromisingly Hindu. And it is from this book that you have the famous slogan, Vande Mataram, I revere the mother, and indeed the song in which that slogan first appears, which has become India's national song. A distinction there between the national song and the national anthem, which I can't go into, partly because the Indian government hasn't quite gone into that distinction. But nevertheless, it is an extremely important slogan. And as you know, the famous lyricist and musician A.R. Rahman has released a CD which was very popular some years ago at the time of India's Independence Day, which was entitled Vande Mataram. So it is still very much a topic of contestation and concern. In fact, this slogan, Vande Mataram, as embedded in the book, was one of the important sticking points for the Muslim League in the run-up to India's independence, and the founder of modern Pakistan, Jinnah, specifically objected, as did many Muslims after him, to the use of this slogan, Vande Mataram, and to its and to the first 12 lines of that hymn in the novel becoming the national song of India. So it played an extremely important role in dividing and homogenizing Muslims from Hindus. I'm writing a book on this, by the way, hence I know so much about it. So in the novel, back to the novel, the children fight directly to overthrow local corrupt Muslim rule. But it is not hard to see that the Muslims are a screen for the author's disenchantment with the British colonial regime and for national opposition to this regime. In one passage, the author, Bankim Chatterjee, writes, I quote, "In particular, everyone was angry with the Muslims for the lawlessness and indiscipline of their rule. Because the Hindu code of life, Hindu dharma, had disappeared, many Hindus were keen to establish a sense of Hindutva, which you can translate of Hindu identity," unquote. This is a very early and significant use of the term Hindutva, and it occurs in a passage affirming Hindu identity over and against that of Muslims. It is also a universalizing use of the term. Hindus are spoken of as a uniform collective without adverting to internal distinctions. Now, I'm not claiming that Bankim invented the modern use of Hindutva, but in what became an important nationalist text, i.e. the novel, Its occurrence reflects and reinforces the term's main import in nationalist discourse subsequently. That is, standardizing Hindu identity in terms of something vague called the Hindu code or way of life in opposition to the other, especially the Muslim other. And you can draw a line of continuity between this use of the term Hindutva in Bunkim's novel in 1882, it first appeared in serial form in 1879 in his journal Bangadarshan. You can draw a line of continuity between this term and its meaning with the more hard-nosed sense given to Hindutva, especially in the political cultural writings of Veer Savarkar, 1883 to 1966, the seminal ideologue of most right-wing groups in India today. In his important tract, Essentials of Hindutva, this is what Savarkar wrote, I quote, "A Hindu is one who feels attachment to the land that extends from Sindhu to Sindhu, sea to sea, as the land of his forefathers, as his fatherland, whereas most Hindus today would speak of motherland, who inherits the blood of the great race, which assimilating all that was incorporated and ennobling all that was assimilated, has grown into and come to be known as the Hindu people, and who as a consequence of the foregoing attributes has inherited and claims as his own the Hindu civilization, as represented in a common history, common heroes, a common literature, a common art, a common law, and a common jurisprudence, common fairs and festivals, rites and rituals, ceremonies and sacraments," unquote. Thus, for Savarkar and his followers, one's appropriation of Hindutva must be accommodated to a view that is racial, territorial, androcentric, culturally conformist, look at the great stress on the word common, and exclusivist of the other. Approaches to Hinduism predicated on these assumptions, which include that of the BJP government or some among them in India and the Sangh Parivar, their followers, at this time, must have the same ideological essentializing characteristics. Now I will pass over in very quickly the reasons for Savarkar's or the assumptions on which Savarkar predicated his own understanding of Hindutva, and that is the Western construct of the nation-state and national identity of his times. And it was a reaction on his part to processes of thought embedded in the colonial agenda in India to distance its regime from the subject peoples, both epistemically and racially. In other words, according to this thinking, this construct from a number of colonial administrators and politicians, the idea was that the Hindus or the Indians are so different from us that there cannot be a real meeting of minds and hearts. This agenda was well established by the time of Savarkar's youth. And Savarkar was really reacting to this sort of carbon copy or a mirror image of this kind of thinking. Also associated with this understanding of Hindutva is the concept of Sanatana Dharma, or the eternal code of the law, which gives the impression that this code is eternal because it remains intact. It is something invisible which manifests and expresses itself from time to time, which can be distorted by cultural excrescences and so on, but which ultimately has to be purified because it is this intact monolithic thing. And the concept of Hindutva and Sanatana Dharma in this sense of the term often go hand in hand. But I do want to make a distinction between these interpretations of what it is to be Hindu and the modern defensive constructs which are popular in the Hindu diaspora, that is among Hindus outside the homeland, not least among young Hindus who live in the West and seek to affirm their Indian roots. For Hindus in the Hindu diaspora, in my experience, I found that this emphasis on Hindutva differs in important respects from the way that this term is used in the homeland. in the diaspora, there is often a greater emphasis on formulating a uniform Hindu identity as an act of self-esteem and self-preservation in the face of alien cultural pressures from an overwhelming host majority. And a concomitant strategy may be to affirm a universalistic understanding of Hinduism in either descriptive or prescriptive terms. That is, this is what all Hindus do believe or should do believe as a sort of reaction to the host community. Antipathy towards the cultural other may not be a priority as it seems to be in the homeland. So I've given a big example of this in terms of some publications, but we can't spend time on that. So now I want to come to the second part of my lecture in the last 15 minutes that are given to me to show what my own approach to Hinduism is in terms of all these political and other constructs that we've just been considering. And I want to do this in a non-essentialist way, so as to leave space, as I said, for different ways of being Hindu. So I'm going to be talking now not about a list of things that you can tick off in order to be recognized as Hindu, but a mentality, a mindset, which seems to, in my understanding, characterize what it is that Hinduness is, as opposed to Hindutva. So first of all, I'd like to emphasize again that Hinduism, designations like Hinduism, can and do perform a useful role as artfully imprecise names. They provide a terminological canopy for legitimating ongoing debate about the nature of the phenomena they address, which in itself implies that they are being used in a methodologically instructive manner. I pass over very quickly, almost in silence, the model of religion that modern designations of Hinduism tend to look towards, and that is a process of appropriation of the model of Christianity. It was against the backdrop of Christianity that Western observers, scholars, administrators, and missionaries entered into their numerous conceptual transactions with Hindus. And by the late 18th century, as this process consolidated its effects in the deployment of British influence and power, the norm for an authentic religious identity was a discernible system of axial corporate belief. So just as Christianity had a creed, as Christianity had a sense of an axial corporate belief system, they were expecting to find this in the religion of the people they governed, and the religion of the and the people they governed tended to fight back in terms of the same structural presuppositions. And that's how modern conceptions of Hinduism began to develop. So now let me talk about my own approach. We have now considered two of the three leading questions raised at the beginning of this lecture. Is there such a thing as Hinduism? And what are the pitfalls of using the term Hinduism unwarily? We can now move on to the third. What kind of thing is Hinduism? Or to put it differently, what is the basis of our own approach to the phenomenon we call Hinduism? Well, in recent work, I've likened Hinduism to the massive banyan tree that is a chief attraction of the botanical gardens on the outskirts of Kolkata, as we must now call it, capital of the Indian state of West Bengal. This is not meant to be an exact comparison, but only a basis for constructing a model of Hinduism that bears functional resemblances to this particular tree. The Kolkata banyan is very old. It has a history of well over 200 years, and in the way of ancient banyans, has put out aerial roots from its branches, which have reached the ground and resemble trunks themselves. For some reason, there appears to be no central axis to this tree, so that the Kolkata banyan looks like a grove of interconnected trees. In fact, there are more than 1,000 trunks with a canopy of about 4 acres. The effect is that of a three-dimensional lattice that is multi-centered. Each of the thicker trunks seems to sustain a microsystem of lesser trunks with their branches, and the whole comes across as an arboreal grid that is one yet many. Now, this is a promising model for the view of Hinduism that I propose, an interconnected polycentric phenomenon in the flux of growth, change, and decay. But there's a difference. As a single organic system, the banyan can display only a limited diversity of its botanic structure. Furthermore, dubious, perhaps parasitic growths can be identified for what they are by accredited scientific means. There are ways of telling botanically whether something is banyan, Ficus bengalensis, or not. This is where the resemblance with the model of Hinduism I am proposing breaks down. On the one hand, I wish to retain the rhetoric of an organic unity in the Hindu banyan. On the other, I wish to allow for a wider range of diversity of its constituent features than in its botanic counterpart with regard to rites, rituals, doctrines, and so on. Further, in terms of social scientific discourse, there seem to be no clear ways of discerning on occasion where the Hindu banyan ends and non-Hindu characteristics take over on occasion. That is, whether something can with confidence be described as Hindu or not. There are problem cases. But none of this is to say that we cannot characterize a great many things, individuals, events, artifacts, systems of thought, modes of speech and behavior, over a wide spectrum of time and space as clearly Hindu. So let us look at certain examples of how this polycentric model works. And let me start with the Veda, which is the canonical Hindu scriptures. Well, to start with the Veda, it may be objected, is to start with a focus of Hinduism that is both elitist and orthodox in important ways, and hence insufficiently comprehensive. But I argue that this objection is misplaced. For our purposes, there is great heuristic advantage in this particular starting point. For by their normative scriptural status, the Vedas have exerted from earliest times to the present enormous influence on all strata of Hinduism as a socio-cultural phenomenon. And this cuts across such distinctions as elite and popular, orthodox and heterodox, and great tradition and little tradition, which social anthropologists sometimes like to and sometimes don't like to use. It is not even important to know what the actual religious content of the Vedas is, because I'm not talking about an essentialist mode of discourse. Suffice it to know that the Vedas are a Brahminical preserve, the preserve of the Brahmins who have edited them and who have protected them and who have propagated them. And that in fact, in the course of time, a widespread tendency arose to regard other texts, some in Sanskrit and others in the vernacular, and hence this process, this model cuts across the elite, orthodox and popular distinction, as more accessible alternative Vedas. So a number of texts arose in the course of time which were also described as Vedas, as alternative Vedas, alternative but not mutually exclusive with respect to their legitimating Vedic source. In fact, they were perceived as entering into an organic relationship with the Vedas, and often with each other, so as to adapt, refract, reissue, disseminate in more accessible and popular ways the salvific power incorporated in the Vedas. And to this end, they were called Veda too. These alternative Vedas include such diverse examples as the great epic narrative, the Mahabharata, the so-called Tamil Vedas of South India, and the large collection of texts called the Puranas. All of these three bodies of texts, which were disseminated for popular discourse and part of the popular imagination, were also called Veda. And the important thing is that their use, their appellation, their description as Veda had an intrinsic connection with the Sanskritic canonical texts. It was not extrinsic. I'll give you an example of an extrinsic connection. We sometimes say that the highway code is the Bible of motorists. We're using the word Bible there in an extrinsic sense, semantically, from the way we speak of the Bible, that means the Old and the New Testament, or the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. But these three bodies of texts which I've given as an example, the Mahabharata, the Tamil Vedas, and the Puranas, are regarded as Veda not in an extrinsic sense. They are actually regarded as giving in a more accessible way the salvific teaching of the Vedas. So the word Veda for them is being used here intrinsically with the original canon. A grid, an interconnected grid, a polycentric grid has been set up between the traditional Vedas and the authority, the Sanskritic Vedas, and the Mahabharata, and its different forms, some in Sanskrit and some in the vernacular, and the Puranas, and the Tamil Vedas, which are written by definition in Tamil. And all these texts are supposed to be in an interactive grid, mediating, reissuing, refracting the original teaching of the Vedas. That's why they are called Vedas, not extrinsically but intrinsically. Now this, I say, is a polycentric phenomenon that is quite distinctive in Sanskritic Hinduism. And I give a go at some length in explaining this distinction and the different moves made by theologians and thinkers. For example, the Vedas are special revelation and the Puranas are general revelation, and so on, in order to explain why it may not be easy actually to find conceptual connecting links between the canonical Vedas and these texts. These are ways for authority to leapfrog from the traditional Vedas into the more popular and vernacular forms of discourse and imagination. So this is one kind of polycentrism, this interactive grid. It's a form of intertextuality that is both decentering and reintegrative. By virtue of its decentering tendency, it can accommodate an indefinite number of members simultaneously in this nexus, in this grid. And insofar as it is reintegrative, it is capable of sustaining itself. The dynamic of the whole polycentric phenomenon permits individual members to be subtracted from or added to the grid in more or less contingent fashion. Vedas can drop out of or enter the system by force of historical circumstance without impairing either the critical mass or the modality of the whole. This is one way in which polycentrism, as a characteristic of the Hindu Banyan, expresses itself. And it is a way of tenacious survival and adaptive propagation. So this is why, one reason why Hinduism has propagated itself and survived over 3,000 years. Not because of its tolerance. It is not tolerant in many respects. But because it has this way of replicating itself in this polycentric phenomenon. Let me give another example. Well, I have, before I go to another example, Kunal Chakrabarty, I say, has shown that similar strategies have been implemented in the medieval Sanskrit Puranas of the Bengal area to draw non-Aryan tantric practices into the Vedic fold during the process of the region's Brahminization. He claims, somewhat sweepingly I think, quote, "There is no direct continuity from the Vedas to the Tantras. Nevertheless, in the Mahabhagavata Purana, the goddess speaks as follows," I quote, "The Agama," here the Tantras, "and the Veda are my two arms with which I sustain the whole universe. If out of ignorance one violates either of these two, he's sure to slip away from my hands. Both the Vedas and the Agamas lead to welfare. Wise people should practice Dharma by accepting these two as identical," unquote. And he gives other examples where relations of equivalence are posited in some way or other between Veda and Tantra. So these are, again, different forms of alternative Vedas that are coming into the grid and forming part of that interactive polycentric phenomenon. But there are other ways by which the polycentric functionality of the Hindu Banyan disperses itself. And let us consider some of these. Our next example has to do with a well-rehearsed method of configuring space and time, with special reference to the modality of pilgrimage in Hinduism. And here is a salient illustration. It is well known that the city of Benares, Kashi is its Sanskritic name, has long been one of the holiest pilgrimage sites, tirthas, for Hindus. The river Ganges at Kashi is believed to be particularly effective with regard to its religiously purificatory role, where the subcontinent is a large place. And Kashi has a definite location. So as in the case of the Veda, which I've just spoken about, this has led to the rise of alternative Kashis related in a similar fashion to the original Kashi, just as you have alternative Vedas related to the original Veda. Diana Eck has described this as follows. I quote from her book as follows. A place such as Kashi is important, even supreme, without being unique. To celebrate one god or one tirtha need not mean to celebrate only one. Far from standing alone, Kashi, like a crystal, gathers and refracts the light of other pilgrimage places. Not only are other tirthas said to be present in Kashi, but Kashi is present elsewhere. In the Himalayas, on the way to the headwaters of the Ganges, the pilgrim will come to a place called the Northern Kashi. This kind of transposition of place is a common phenomenon in Indian sacred topography. The affirmation is that the place itself, with its sacred power, is present in more than one place, just as the Veda is present in more than one text. In addition to the Northern Kashi, there is a Southern Kashi and a Shiva Kashi in the Tamil South. In a similar way, the river Ganges is a prototype for other sacred waters, and her presence is seen in countless rivers and invoked into ritual waters all over India, unquote. So here's another way this system of interactive centers works in order to disperse the power of one place into the grid of other centers, thereby generating or replicating itself anew in these other centers, so that if one collapses in some way or the other, the same power is distributed and replicated in other members of this interactive grid. This is what I mean by polycentrism. Thus, from the point of view of our example of a privileged pilgrimage site, there is, by contrast, but one Mecca to which the Haji must travel, one Rome to which the pilgrim must come, one Jerusalem, one wailing wall to which the faithful must defer. The Abrahamic faiths do not have this polycentric phenomenon. And that is why you need to go to a particular geographical place in order to fulfill your obligations. Whereas in the case of Kashi, you can go to the Northern Kashi, the Southern Kashi, depending on availability and circumstance. Because the same power of the original Kashi is available in these other places. But in the Hindu world, therefore, the symbiotic multipolar dispersals of potency or shakti of which we speak exist in dense and far-flung matrices over a wide spectrum of speech and behavior patterns, dispersing the ones and reintegrating the manys. Let me give you another example. And notice I'm taking the work of scholars like Diana Eck, now Shulman, and then Inden, to show that they have actually described this phenomenon, not quite in the way I'm doing it, but to use the scholarship of other scholars in order to put it together in such a way that you get an insight into what is going on, so that I'm using their scholarship in support as a collaborative method for my own point of view. Both Shulman and Inden have written on patterns of kingship in medieval Hindu polity. Adverting to Shulman elsewhere, in another article, I have noted, quote, painting a synthetic portrait of the medieval South Indian state, Shulman contends that in this state, no single center exists. The state has no real boundaries. Instead, one would gradually become aware of a varied, shifting series of centers of different kinds and functions connected with various interlocking networks, unquote. This is exactly the phenomenon of polycentrism. Inden, in his book Imagining India, surprisingly does not mention Shulman, yet his own treatment of Hindu statecraft in medieval central India complements that of Shulman, taking it further and more explicitly in the direction of our own thesis. Indon demonstrates how it was customary for rulers in the region to legitimate their kingly authority by strategies of transposition, that is, by superimposing the features of a sacred topography located elsewhere geographically upon counterparts in their own territory, rather as in the case of Kashi described above, in order to affirm the divine validation of their own rule. I quote now from Indon. When we consider that all rivers were said ultimately to originate from the Ganga, the Ganges, when we take into account the fact that some of the Puranas refer to the Godavari and the Krishna, the rivers constituting the imperial domains of the Rashtrakutas in Middle Eastern India, as Gangas of the South, when we remember that the Rashtrakutas were talking about these topographical features, that is, Mount Kailasha, the dwelling place of Shiva and the Ganges, not simply as physical places, but as the domains of purposive agents interacting with time, country, universal king, and cosmic overlord to make and remake a divinized polity, it all makes good sense. Unquote. Quite exactly my point. In other words, it was characteristic for these rulers to justify their political goals in terms of what I have described above as polycentric modalities. Now, I'm not claiming that you do not have aspects of what I've called polycentrism, and there are other examples. The so-called polytheism of Hinduism is really a polymorphous monotheism. It is the same deity appearing in different forms, in different places, expressing itself in different locations with the same power in terms of this interactive grid. Similarly, for the concept of dharma, the concept of dharma has different aspects: stri dharma, the dharma of women, kshatriya dharma, the dharma of caste, and different forms of dharma, all different modalities of the one underlying power of dharma. Similarly, in certain Hindu philosophies, the word shabda is expressed and manifested in lots of different centers and modalities as part of interactive grid, and so on and so forth. I can even give you an example from that famous photographer Raghubir Sen, whose work is such that, as a Western critic said, the eye does not rest on a single focus, but is led to multiple focuses in his particular work, which is a very distinctive, I call, Hindu way of trying to propagate a perspective on the world. So in lots of different ways, which needs to be further studied and taken forward, you have this phenomenon of polycentrism, this interactive grid of multiple centers drawing from each other, feeding each other, existing and dispersing and decentering the one power system that they all represent in different ways. And I think this is very characteristic and distinctive. It's not essentialist. It doesn't actually, it's a way of approach, it's an orientation. It's a mentality, which I think is what Hinduness is. And as I say, this is work in progress. But it is very characteristic of what we tend to call Hinduism, though it may occur, aspects of it may occur in other religious traditions, in other contexts of human expression. And I can think of one, for example, the use and the belief in relics. In Christianity, though there the problem can get a little more difficult, and especially when you encounter 12 skulls of St. John the Baptist dispersed around different churches in the world, you would hardly expect him to be a 12-headed person. So there the problem, even there the problem is different. So let me end now. I'm not claiming that what I've called polycentrism does not exist in some form elsewhere. There may well be evidence of this complex phenomenon in other cultures and faiths. What I am claiming is that as a way of ordering the world microcosmically and macrocosmically, it has been sufficiently pervasive historically in the seething totality we are pleased to call Hinduism, so as to make it a leading if not the leading characteristic of this tradition, and that as such this makes Hinduism distinctive. That is a bold claim. But I hope I have given a glimpse, not least by collating and reconfiguring evidence drawn from a wider scholarship, not only textual but also sociological and anthropological, of this phenomenon, and that I've indicated that it merits serious scrutiny and collaborative research. What the future holds in store is uncertain. As I've hinted earlier, homogenizing forces have made an appearance in a post-independence secular India, where secular has a meaning all its own, amid the rampant pressures of a crushing globalization. It may be that the history of Hinduism is about to take a sharp turn. Whether this would be for the better or for the worse remains unclear. On the other hand, it could be that these homogenizing forces themselves develop polycentric modalities of their own. In that case, the momentum of history may yet triumph, and an enduring tradition that I have sought to describe in fluid rather than in essentializing terms may continue to survive, adapt, and reform itself in humanly and humanely creative ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Lipner, for a wonderful and stimulating presentation. Several people obviously need to go to other places, and that's fine. But Professor has agreed to take some questions and have some discussion, maybe for 15 minutes or so, if that's okay. So who would like to begin us off with a question on any of the aspects of this many multifaceted presentation?
Thank you very much for the lecture. We have basically two questions. The first one, actually, I would like to know if you can clarify on your concept of polycentrism. You mentioned that other texts had really the function of giving the salvific teachings of the Vedas. I wonder if it's not a bit exaggerated.
Well, that was the claim. The claim may be exaggerated. I'm talking about the process. I mean, the Mahabharata, there's a famous statement in the Mahabharata. What is not here is nowhere else, and what is what you find here you need not look anywhere else for. I mean, the Mahabharata, and there are many the statements in the Mahabharata saying anyone who reads or recites this or that aspect of it acquires heaven or salvation or insight or wisdom. If you look at the great hymns of the Alvars and the Nayanas of South India, which I mentioned, the Tamil Veda, these are salvific texts, and they are recited in temples today, in the Sri Vaishnava temples and Shaiva temples, as texts that express the devotionalism that brings union with God and salvation. And they are supposed to be, these are bits I skipped over, where you have certain Sri Vaishnava theologians who say, this is indeed a Veda. This is a Veda because it is a revelation to the Tamils. This is a special revelation. The Veda is locked up with all sorts of ritual protections and safeguards. And in God's graciousness, he has given us this Tamil Veda in order to reveal ourselves. But it is, and they try and show the same teaching because it is a special revelation. It can only be special if the Veda is a general revelation. And so on. These theological moves are made. Same for the tantras of Bengal, the Bengal tantras of the 9th to the 13th, 15th centuries. I gave a quotation where the goddess says, one arm is the tantras, the other arm is the Vedas. You need both arms for the following of dharma. Now, the actual theological moves to show that the teaching of the tantras is similar to the teaching of the Vedas may be obscure. But the claim is being made not that this is a so-called Veda, but that this is really something that expresses the mystery of the teaching of the original Vedas, which are very hard to interpret, which have been closed by Brahmins and so on. So I'm talking about certain moves that are made rather than exegetical connections, which may be very difficult to find.
Yeah, because I'd like to know who is making these moves. I mean, what comes to my mind as far as Vedas come, when it comes to salvation, I think about the Upanishads. And we do have various instances where, you know, this is, we have talks about the Upanishad of Purusha, you know, this Purusha which is taught through the Upanishads alone. So when it comes to salvation, I would have difficulty, you know, in considering that Vedanta can actually give that kind of authority to text, kind of text or,
we may all have difficulty. I'm not disputing the exegetical difficulty.
Yes.
What I'm trying to say is that it was felt important to claim that the Vedic revelation of these alternative texts was in fact a Vedic revelation, and that the term Veda was being used with the same authority and power, and that's the important thing, as the original Veda. Unlike the case when we say the Highway Code is the Bible of motorists. There was there an intrinsic semantic connection. That's the moves that they were making. And this is only the case of scripture authority. And I gave also the case of the Tirthas, of the pilgrimage, the statecraft, polity, and so on. So something is going on there in terms of what I call polycentrism, which is quite universal. And it bridges the gulf between elite and popular and orthodox and heterodox. For example, there are so many Ramayanas, and Paula Richmond has written a book on the number of Ramayanas there are. And they're all interconnected texts. I mean, the same authority and power of the original Ramayana, Valmiki Ramayana, emerges in the Tulsidas Ramayana, the Dhyatma Ramayana, and so on. So you can see this going on in across the spectrum. Yes.
I was thinking that probably there's a need to legitimize tantric text in a new area rather than, and that's why they take on, they use the term Vedic, I mean, that it is the Veda, like when you're talking about Bengal tantras. So, and in the South also, we know that there's a constant need for legitimization, authenticating a text or a ritual by saying it's Vedic. So, you know, Vedic is the oldest, and therefore, that's one thing. And the second thing, I just wanted to know, when you said there are certain features which are incontestably Hindu, did you mean polycentrism? That is incontestably Hindu. Is that what you said?
Let me come to your first question.
Okay.
I'm not disputing that there are sociological, anthropological, historical explanations, political explanations. I mean, legitimating is the name of the game.
Yeah.
And even for these kings who were saying that the Ganges, that the river that flows in our domain and the mountain that you see in our domain, even though geographically they may be 2,000 miles away from Mount Kailasha where Shiva dwells in the Himalayas, and the real Ganges is another 500 miles away outside their territory, nevertheless, this is an expression of the Ganges, and this mountain in my domain is an expression of Mount Kailasha. And therefore Shiva himself legitimates my claim to authority. So these are the moves that were being made, and those rivers were actually treated as if they were expressions of the one Shakti or power of the Ganges, and that this mountain became another center in which Shiva dwelt, another form of Mount Kailasha. Of course, these were legitimating moves.
But what about the local? What about the popular? What about the idiom that is there, the regional idiom?
Oh, yes.
I mean, that's sort of like just being put on the side.
No. You have multiple appellations. This is the whole point. Hindus work in terms of multiple appellations and multiple descriptions. I give an example. I visited Mauritius in the South Pacific. It's wonderful when you write to someone in Mauritius, in Mauritius, South Pacific. Anyway, I visited Mauritius in the South Pacific, and as you know, 60% of the population are what we would call Hindus, Tamil, and so on and so forth. And they have the political power now in an independent Mauritius. And in the center of the island, Mauritius was for 100 years under French colonial rule, then for 100 years under British colonial rule after the French. So every educated Mauritian speaks Creole, the Patois, English with a French accent, and a vernacular perhaps. So these, the names of this, of a big lake in the center of Mauritius, were given by the French and the British. and these names appear on the maps. But the local population calls the lake around which, the central lake around which you have different temples, Ganga Talab, that is the Ganges Lake. Why? Because they were thousands of miles away from the homeland and from the original Ganges. So someone years ago went to the Ganges, took 6 or 8 pitchers of Ganges water, poured it into the lake, and that is a new expression of the Ganges. It sanctifies and sacralizes as another center of this polycentric grid. The Shakti of the Ganges is visible there, and it is acknowledged. So it has 3 names, 4 names. So these legitimate, you don't have to go all the way back to the geographical location, physical location, in order to have the Shakti or the power of the Ganges. But this occurs in so many different ways, across so many divides. And I think that it's the sheer momentum and the force of what is going on, scripturally, pilgrimage-wise, textually, in terms of morals, dharma, in terms of religious worship of the images and so on. It's so pervasive that it